5, 4, 3.
And this is episode 25 of A Podcast Without a Name.
No diggity, no doubt. Episode 25.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
For December 25th, which is Christmas. Merry Christmas, everybody. Yes.
This would be our kind of our Christmas special, if you will. Hopefully we get it out for Christmas. We'll try.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, we can do is try, Joe.
Maybe we'll be lucky and get it out by the first day of Kwanzaa, December 26th.
Okay, we'll go for that.
Well, happy Kwanzaa, everybody.
Happy Kwanzaa, everyone. Merry Christmas, happy Kwanzaa, and happy holidays. We are the podcast without a name. This is our first episode after our one-year anniversary episode.
That is true. Happy one-year anniversary and a month.
Minus one, would it be? Well, yeah, I guess, yeah. Month, probably. Just about. No, about 3 weeks, right? I don't remember.
Yeah,
I don't even
know anymore.
Where the hell am I? I don't even know what I'm doing right now. What are you guys drinking?
I'll let you guess.
The one with the
that is correct. I did go back.
Surfboard.
I'm trying to relive my summer days by going back to a tropical IPA. Hanalei.
How about you, Rich? What are you on?
Narragansett, the official beer of Quint from Jaws.
Oh, yes. Nice. That's one of your favorites lately, by the way. I noticed.
It is one of your favorites.
Yeah. I'm drinking Crown and Ginger, but I just finished that up in our whole audio test segment that no one else heard. But I'm about to crack open just to follow up with a Stella.
Excellent choice. Mm-hmm.
Just keeping it classic, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always a Shaw. Classic.
Right.
Shaw. Right.
Shaw.
So a lot has happened, by the way, since our last podcast. Before we dive into that stuff.
Yeah, there's been tons to talk about. In fact, I don't know. We can't even fit it all into one cast because there's so much to talk about.
It's going
to
be too much. So but what we really do need to talk about, though, is the 83 and 80-year-old who was just locked up. I believe it was Nebraska when they were traveling across state lines with 336,000 dollars worth of weed as a holiday gift. That was their excuse to the police.
Merry Christmas.
I wonder where they're
Ganja
going.
Ganja claws.
Where are they headed? Anyone actually read the story? I saw the headline. I kind of glossed over. I was like, that's pretty interesting. Like, these really old people were trying to bring weed to their family.
They were pulled over for a traffic violation in the town of Bradshaw.
Ooh. Was it really Nebraska, too? Did I get that right?
You know, I don't remember. I'd have to read the story back again.
Ah, yes, it was Nebraska. I say it. Oh, there's music playing. You guys hear that?
No, that's your ad on your.
Oh my God, it's still doing it. It's like hardcore.
It was doing it to me. I told you. Yeah.
Legit. I'm going to get rid of this webpage then. Anyway. All right. Anyway, I thought it was funny.
It's pretty funny.
If you said,
anyone have any other?
That's not corn.
That's not corn.
Yeah, that's not corn, guys.
Did you anyone know of any other fun news before we jump into really serious stuff that we all get depressed drinking our alcohol?
Well, I don't know. I thought this was actually pretty fun. They said that the marijuana was for Christmas presents, according to York County's lieutenant.
Can you imagine if, like, you went to your Christmas Eve party with your family and your grandmother and grandfather just pulled out, like, bags of weed and said, Merry Christmas?
Oh, they were on their way to Vermont, by the way. Oh, Vermont. That was where they were going. From Nebraska to Vermont. And they remain in 83-year-old is in custody in York County jail on charges of possession of marijuana with the intent to deliver, as well as having no drug tax stamp.
Well, there you go. That's what did them in. The drug tax stamp. But, you know, I hope they at least let them smoke up before they locked them up. It's like, here, old people, smoke this up. We'll throw you in a cell.
Who cares?
Well, they're not the only ones looking for weed-themed ideas for Christmas stocking fillers, apparently.
Oh.
Just think of all the fruit.
So, according to this webpage, it says that some of the past year's most popular products from the industry include marijuana mints, infused vegan chocolate and skin moisturizer.
Interesting. Rich, what are you saying?
Oh, God.
No, I just said a picture like all the fruitcake and cookies and other delicious bakeable goods you can make with that much weed.
I bet it would be very interesting.
Bring it to your bring Christmas it to your party. Your Christmas party, your little holiday party.
So there's
anybody that doesn't. No, I was just going to say anybody that doesn't know, edibles is where it's at.
It's the trend, right?
I wouldn't say it's a trend. I mean, it's just who wants to get like a scratchy, dry throat and like bloodshot eyes, and you know, we could just eat like a cookie and feel amazing.
Yeah. That sounds like not a bad idea. You know, maybe one day when this is all legal across the country and being a government employee myself, it'll probably take the government another 10 years after that. So you guys will probably be able to enjoy it before me, but one day.
Not me in my industry.
Yeah, I mean, for you guys. Well, you being in the, you know, the electric supply industry that's heavily regulated, it's probably going to be, yeah, you're probably very similar to the government with that.
Yeah.
In that regard.
Yeah. It's something about intoxication and working on high voltage electrical lines that they don't like.
Well, then they should be coming after you for drinking beer, man.
Yeah.
That's it. They're going to get you.
Hopefully they don't listen to this podcast.
Anyway, so that was our fun topic of the evening before we dive into kind of, you know, the serious stuff that we normally talk about. So what we have on the agenda this evening is just a concept for which I was thinking about earlier and we discussed a little bit privately. Things that become obstacles when we engage in conversations with people, whether it be social media or in person, wherever it be. This is probably kind of timely too, because we'll all be seeing family probably for the holidays, and maybe this will help kind of us kind of make sense of some of the craziness that we encounter. So we're going to talk about obstacles to civility and dialectics. And then, you know, maybe we'll talk a little bit about the tax bill, which might dovetail well with some of the concepts we have in that first segment. And then we could talk about the U.S. moving the embassy to Jerusalem if we have time. And then we'll open it up if we happen to have time after that for whatever. So one of the things that I really want to touch on, and the things I just kind of think about in my 45-minute drive to work, and, you know, if I'm just sitting there in traffic and nothing's going on, one of the things that pops in my head often is how people formulate arguments, how people engage in arguments. And I know it's something we've been frustrated with social media. And one of the reasons why we are doing a podcast is to kind of start creating conversations. And so I notice a trend in people taking up technical or academic terms and misusing them or misapplying them. And I think we could have a little discussion about that. And what I mean about this is I like to give an example of when people use the antisocial personality disorder. You hear people kind of throw that out just in regular conversation when they encounter someone they think fits that profile. It's often misapplied, and that's why it's a great example. But when someone says antisocial, they tend to peg it on someone who looks like they're introverted or withdrawing from social situations, when in fact having an antisocial personality disorder is actually described in the DSMs, is quite the opposite. They actually engage or seek out social situations. They just don't act within traditional societal mores, and they tend to be pervasive and persistent and disregard morals and social norms and things like that. So it's just that's just like a quick little understanding, and to kind of add on to that, and we could talk about this more because I know Anthony is really interested in this. As we see it in like current topics, like when we're talking about the tax policy and things like that, when people use things like trickle down, what they're really talking about is supply side versus demand side economics. But before we jump into that, I just want to kind of make one quick point in all this. And I'm sure you've encountered this, where you're maybe having a short online debate with someone, or maybe a long one, and they throw out things like straw man or Dunning-Kruger, and they try to accuse you of using these things. And I think it's important to understand. So by the way, Dunning-Kruger effect is when someone who thinks they're an expert on something, but they're so far from being an expert that they can't recognize that they're not.
Well, so, and that's actually isn't that in that's actually part of a bias, right? That's what's one of like
yeah,
the
it's
main
a bias, yeah,
biases, right?
Yeah,
okay.
But but real quick, yeah, you're right. It is a bias. But if you're in a conversation with someone and they point they say to you, "Oh, that's a straw man," or you're Dunning-Kruger right now, or something like that. The issue with that is if you're actually using it and you're formulating your opinions and arguments, you're probably misapplying it and you're probably not understanding it because those terms aren't meant to be used as a mode to make an argument or explain your rationale. They're meant as an to characterize observations, right? If you're observing a debate and you're judging a debate, right, in a professional setting, mm-hmm. You're gonna understand what strawman is because you're looking for it in the debate content, right? You're not if you actually see someone throw out to the other debater that they're using strawman, that's actually out of context and doesn't make sense, right? Like you wouldn't mm-hmm. say that. It's meant to observe and bin things and help you understand things, right? That's kind of like something that like bothers me. It's like, no, if you're saying this to me, clearly you're probably not understanding what I'm trying to say because you're doing this and you're probably not really understanding the concept for which you're applying these things.
In the examples of Dunning-Kruger or, strawman, you actually would probably be judged by how like bringing that to somebody or portraying that to somebody else. You would probably be guilty of
actually doing that
particular cognitive bias that is kind of funny, you know what I mean, like to it kind of relays off of itself, you know, to that person that would actually be using those terms, because they're using those terms for what? They're using those terms in a with an intention of, you know, maybe making themselves sound, you know, like they're, I don't know,
educated on it or something,
educated more, or, you know, they have more of a you know, knowledge of social norms and stuff like that.
It's,
you know,
almost like it's almost like the same, it's the same concept for when people withdraw to grammar, right? Mm-hmm. If suddenly in an argument someone starts picking back at grammar, they're doing it because they're probably feeling like they're on their heels. If they're starting to pull these things, like trying to throw these concepts out to try to characterize that you're wrong, mm-hmm. They're probably on their heels, and they're also looking for fillers, right? It becomes lazy. It's almost like adding like to everything, which I do all the time, right?
Yeah, of
like,
course. Well, that's our own brain, you know, putting a filler in, right? So I mean, like when we say and you know, every language,
like
an
is fine, but this is more like a cognitive, like you're actually like you don't know how to say what you're trying to say, or maybe you were, maybe technically you were defeated, so you're just like, well, that's straw man, or no, you're thinking like a Dunning-Kruger effect, like you just throw it out there, right? Like
you know what's an interesting one that comes to mind immediately when we're talking about this. Is one of the most simple arguments that I've been presented with when somebody wants to argue something that I believe to be inaccurate. The first thing they'll say is, and it could be about something like very complex, right? Mm-hmm. We could say trickle down or supply side economics. We could say what it doesn't have to be that. It could be anything with mm-hmm. a very complex background that you have to have, like, you know, somewhat of a knowledge of, you know, whatever subject in order to talk about, right? Yeah. And they'll say, well, if you know, if that's what you believe to be true, why don't you explain it really quick to me? And it's like, you know, they're almost trying to draw you into this situation where, you know, you can't easily you know, talk about or debate over a Facebook thread, you know what I mean, or a 2-second conversation or a text message about something, because it's so complex, you know, in its, you know, entirety, that, you know, they'll lead you to this, you know, situation where you have to actually like talk about it in a very simplistic manner, which doesn't really do it justice, and it gives them a better ability to pick you apart, you know what I mean, and I don't even know that they do it. These people do it on purpose.
It's just how it goes.
In an effort to, but it just, you know, the oversimplification of everything, A, is easier to share on Facebook, And yeah. B, it's easier to counter an argument because it's oversimplifying a very complex subject.
Yeah, and you gave like an example.
I had a situation just today, actually, talking about, you know, somebody had mentioned something about trickle down and, you know, let's give all the big corporations and everybody tax cuts and, you know, nobody's going to see any money from that trickle down theory. You know, if you believe in trickle down, you believe in, you know, Santa. I don't know. Like, he said something funny like that. And I said, well, you know, it's a lot more complex than that, I think, you know, and that's all I said to him. And he's like, oh, well, why don't you explain it to me then? And I'm like, okay, like, do I need to explain this to you? So, you know, I said, all right, well, you know, I could, I guess sum up, like, you know, however many years of college I went to and, you know, all the research that I've done in my past into one Facebook post, but it probably won't mm-hmm. really, you know, happen, you know what I mean? Like, or even be coherent enough to, you know, and I actually said to him, I'm like, that's if you even were to read what I say, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, too long, don't read. You're guilty of that.
I am like such a, like, especially on social media, right? If you're on social media, like, don't get me wrong, I will cherry pick good long art, like, posts. Like, there was one Rich wrote the other day I did, and I thought it was great. But it's like, if you're on social media with really long, it's like, man, I'm already like on different, I'm you know how we are. Like, I prepare for our podcast. I'm on I'm on Google Scholar all the time. Like, I'm reading like things that are like purposeful. Like, I started reading the tax bill the other day. It's over 1,000 mm-hmm. pages, right? Like, yeah. I don't have time to then jump on Facebook and go, all right, let me read this like 45 minute paragraph in this Facebook post. Right?
It becomes the same frustration that we have seen over and over and over again for the past year, you know, that we've been doing this podcast and far beyond that, you know, before that, which caused us to do this podcast. But, you know, the oversimplification of things, I'll call it, you know, the generalizing of, you know, a certain social group or oversimplification of a very complex issue. You know what I mean? They, you know, memes, which were, you know, funny for a while, became also a way to have some sort of outsider that nobody knows create some sort of quote that is supposed to hold some sort of weight by over, and it's oversimplifying a very complex issue. Like, for instance, one of the memes I saw today was like, you know, taking away, you know, or making the poor man pay for the top 1% to pay less taxes. You know, how is that going to trickle down and help everybody? And I forget how it was presented, but I was kind of like, well, that's not really, you know, what we're looking at here. And there's so much more to
it
that.
It is frustrating, but because your example is a really good one. And I'll add another example to that. But the trickle down concept, trickle down is not an real economic theory, right? Mm-hmm. It was created by detractors of supply side economics, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're going to talk about trickle down, you're really talking about supply side. So in which case you need to educate yourself on supply side economics. And you also have to put in a context of demand side economics, Keynesian, mm-hmm. right? So you have to just talk about, oh, trickle down doesn't work. You have to understand it within the context of supply side versus demand side. And what has that gotten us, right? And this is such a great example because you know how I am and how I think we all are. Like, I tend to think we as Americans or America have done things better than most, right? We haven't had a truly supply side economy. We haven't had a truly demand side economy. But I'll tell you one thing. If you're going to sit here and say trickle down hasn't worked for us, then that you have to partially agree that America has failed, right?
Right.
As a great experiment, right? Which is not the case. I mean, we had the largest economy, we had the largest GDP. Like, we are the most powerful economy in the history of the world. Something worked economically, and part of that is trickle down, aka supply side. Yeah.
Yeah, and it also depends on, sorry to interrupt you, it also mm-hmm. depends on the context that you're using trickle down. Like, so what I've noticed is trickle down is usually a term that's used, and for some reason a lot of people I've noticed it mostly on the far left, I'm not going to generalize left people, but left-leaning people, but on the far left, I've noticed that it's been something that's shared often, that the idea or the context of trickle down surrounds itself with If you give, let's say, the top 1% a tax break or more money, that they're just going to hand their workers more money. And that's not the case. That's not what we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, one of the examples that I've used in the past, I mean, in the past, was that when we saw, you know, an economic downturn, and you had companies that were kind of going down for their own issues that they may have caused themselves, whether it was the banks, mortgage companies, and et cetera. You know, what we saw was a decline in our economy, right? And along with the decline in economy, you also had shareholders pull out of the market. Mm-hmm. You had, you know, which affects people in various ways, including long-term investments like retirement, layoffs, you know, things like that. So, you know, when you say, like, okay, if a big company or a big corp, you know, as people will say, loses money or has less of a bottom line, sure, we're going to feel that, you know, and in a sense, that's what the context of trickle down that they're using is. You know, we will feel that there's going to be a loss of jobs. There's going to be a downturn in the stock market. There's going to be, you know, other things that happen. Whereas the opposite could happen. If a company is doing well, the stock market's doing well, they can add to their bottom line. They can keep consumer products at a good price where the consumer can A, have a job to pay for it, B, actually be in the market to buy stuff. You know, and the other side of that as well is, all right, you know, you give the 1% more money, they're probably the biggest spenders in the country as well. So you're also adding money to the, you know, bottom line of the country's economics as well. So, like, you know, there's so much that goes into it. I mean, I could literally probably hold a 8-week class on it, you know, talking about just something that's actually like an out of context, you know what I mean? Like, and it's very interesting to see what people feel that actually means or what it means to them. We look at it as, you know, the big bad wolf when we're talking about big corp and government, but at the same time, and, you know, I agree to an extent with certain things, especially when it comes to wage gap and corruption that's involved with, you know, lobbyists and stuff like that. But, you know, if you're just talking about the economics of it, you know, bottom line of a company is the bottom line of a company. And, you know, when you give tax breaks and stuff like that, it will eventually, well, if the company works in an ethical way and they're in a consumer-based company, like a consumer-based sales, you're going to see that at the middle class level. You know what I mean? Yeah. It will, you know, quote unquote, trickle down in a sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's not like they're going to give you money. You know, that's not what trickle down means. They're not going to just give you money.
Give me my money.
It means that, give me my money. Hey, it just means that, man, we're going to see benefits of it, you know?
Yeah. Rich, what were you saying?
Well, the one thing that I found, and I'll go back to grad school, striking, was when I was reading about, you know, just supply side economics, Keynesian economics, is that they both kind of have the same goal. They just want to go about it in different ways. So with the supply side economics, obviously they feel like deregulation, letting the market, you know, be free is the best way to get to having a large, what is that, GNP, gross national product, which is essentially the wealth of the nation or whatever. but on the other side, you know, they say, like, oh, well, maybe if you raise the corporate tax rate to, you know, 70%, then that would incentivize businesses to do, you know, capital investments, you know, build new buildings and, you know, upgrade their equipment so they could write that off so that they wouldn't be paying so many taxes. And then, you know, the supply side says, well, if we didn't make them pay taxes in the first place, they would be making those same capital investments and upgrading their equipment and everything else. And so it's kind of weird because they both want the same thing and they both hypothesize that the same thing will happen, but they just seem to go about it in very drastically different ways. And I think pretty much that's what we've seen over the course of, you know, our history. You know, it's always been an ebb and flow, like Joe kind of taught me before about monetary cycles, how, you know, we are kind of in a boom and bust economy. There's things that happen when regulations are rolled back and business does really well, and then some kind of bubble will burst and the stock market will fall, and then all of a sudden they want to regulate all these businesses and they want to increase taxes, and then you have a period of stagnation and, you know, so on and so forth. But it's weird because they, you know, the gist that I got of the reading that I did was that they both theorize that the same exact thing will happen. They just pretty much want to do it by opposite ends of the spectrum.
I think people also forget, you know, a lot of times, and it's one of the frustrations that I have, is that we are in a global economy, right? And, you know, when you look at what you do to, you know, I'm going to use terms that people have been throwing around, the top 1% or big corp or whatever, okay? When you do things that affect their bottom line in any way, because let's be honest, some of the high execs in some of the big corporations are making exuberant amounts of money that they probably shouldn't be making that much, you know, but who am I to say that, right? Regardless, they're not going to change that. Okay. What can change is their bottom line. They're going to figure out a way to affect their bottom line. So the same people that don't want them to pay less tax or add to their bottom line because they're the big bad wolf, well, they're the same people that are going to get angry when that same corporation says, well, you know what, I'm going to take my operations overseas because I could do it cheaper and I'm going to add to my bottom line that way then. You know what I mean? So, you know, in a sense, to me, reducing corporate tax is almost a way to incentivize, you know, some companies. I mean, it depends on the nature of their company, obviously, to add to their bottom line and stay here rather than look for avenues to cut costs. You know what I mean? That doesn't go for already global companies. Obviously, they've done what they've done already, you know, but there's plenty of big corporations that are still in the United States that, you know, are going to be looking at keeping their shareholders happy. And that means, you know, keeping their earnings per share high. And that means keeping their bottom line at the largest that they can get it. And that sometimes means slimming down the company and restructuring and maybe going overseas or whatever it is. Now you drop tax, you know, you bring this tax reform into it and you're dropping their overall tax base. Well, you have a situation where you're immediately adding to their bottom line, which was before a fixed variable cost, you know, that they had, you know, for the past however long that they've been paying the taxes that they have been. So
I was just going to say, and to speak to Anthony's point, something else I was reading actually the other day, it was a person who owned a manufacturing company, and he said there's kind of a myth going around that America takes their jobs overseas because of cheap labor. He said that that's not really the case. He said, you know, people in China aren't now getting paid pretty equally, you know, to people in America. It's just that maybe not people on the factory floor, mind you, but he said it's a skill deficit. He said, you know, if I wanted to manufacture something in America, there's not as many people that are in that area of manufacturing in the United States. He said, if I, you know, proposed an idea to manufacture a product in America, you know, I might be able to, you know, fill half of like a conference room. He said, if I went to China and proposed the same idea, I could probably fill 200 conference rooms with people that could do the same thing. It's like a skill deficit, not so much as like a cheap labor or a cheap production cost deficit. It's that people really aren't into manufacturing things in the same way that China is. It's you know, kind of something that's taught over there, where over here it's not really taught to be something that people should go into.
Yeah. So guys, I'm gonna officially switch us over to our next topic, the tax bill situation, only because we're kind of talking about implications with that. I had a whole thing I want to talk about in the context of this with white privilege, but I'm gonna scratch that. We'll use that for another day. But I want to throw kind of a theoretical proposition to you guys and get your take on this. Now, we often talk about the information age, in particular, the rise of the internet, which is kind of old at this point. But social media and the movement of information like that, right? Organic movement of information in most cases Could we be seeing in this tax bill, I think we noted on our Facebook page, AT&T, Wells Fargo, another bank, Comcast, and several other companies have come out and said, hey, because of this corporate tax cut, we're going to give a bonus for the holidays, which was signed today. So some of these companies will actually pay out these bonuses, and we'll hold them to that, and we'll follow up with that. But and raise their minimum wage to $15 per hour. Could we be seeing this switch from pre-modernity? Like we talked about this in other concepts, but for businesses in America, because we talk about it as individuals, like how do we handle social media, the movement of information and false fake news and things like that. But we don't often talk about it in the context of businesses and how they operate in our economy and how they've adapted to the movement of information. Obviously, stock markets and financial sector is one thing in terms of that type of stuff and like reporting earnings and things like that. But are we switching gears here where because of the way information is moved and the ability of consumers to, kind of really hone in and really be very smart about every dollar they spend, more so than they did 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years ago, that now these companies are actually realizing we have to pay attention to our consumers at a more meta level, if you will, and understand the trends in the social sphere, that when government or things go in our favor, that if we don't react in kind, it's going to be highlighted and it's ultimately going to hurt us. Right. So have we switched phases in terms of business, and have we modernized how business interacts with society and the information age, if you will? That the information age sounds old to me, but the whole concept, like, is there almost like a whole new realm in business now that they have to take in account? Like, because I could tell you this, with Trump in office and these type of corporate tax cuts, although a lot of people are getting money back on this, not just corporations and wealthy people, but businesses are getting money back. People are taking a lot of note of that, and in particular, political parties are taking note of this as a political ammunition, right? It would make sense for them to recognize that and return something in kind, right?
I think any company that is smart right now would know that you should probably try to follow the trend, right? If we learn anything from Donald Trump, it is to only speak on what people or the majority of people want to hear, whether or not it's true, right? Yeah. And, you know, that's how he won his election. True or not, he said a bunch of shit that people wanted to hear. You know what I mean? And yeah, they voted. And, you know, what I see right now with some of these companies coming out and saying, like, hey, you know, we're going to give a bonus, you know, hike wages and stuff like that. That's great. I mean, I love to hear that, of course. However, I can't help but feel that that is just them paying attention to the news, and they're trying to spin a positive PR move in terms of their company with a bunch of negative that's going around there. You know what I mean?
And it attaches itself to it. Isn't that smart? If you think about it, like, wouldn't it make sense? Like,
It's a great idea. And I think that's going to do well. And I can't see these companies following up in the long term. You know, in their eyes, it's a cost in the short term where they can give a few bonuses, raise a few wages in the short term while it's in the spotlight. And then once the tax reform thing kind of is out of the sensationalized media, that they'll just kind of, you know, leave well enough alone at that point and not continue on with
it. But that's the beauty of political cycles, right? Because sure, as much as I want term limits for congressmen, but, you know, it's still all very temporary, right? I mean, mm-hmm, no matter what, I mean, you could have a whole new Congress in a year, and yeah, you could be talking about a whole reversal of all of this. Right.
Yeah.
Unless absolutely their constituents are extremely happy and they got a grin from ear to ear because their tax return's bigger, they're getting paid more, and they're getting bonuses. Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think really at the end of the day, the thing that we'll talk the most is what's in everybody's pocket, you know, yeah, at the end of the year. Yeah. And really when we talk about anything from net neutrality to tax reform to all the hot topics that are in the news cycles right now. All of them leave a lot to be considered on the table right now, because I think we're not going to be able to see what they're actually about until they come into fruition.
Yeah,
there's a lot of naysayers, a lot of, you know, proponents to it.
There's great arguments on both sides of all these topics. There's
great arguments on both of the topics, exactly. And I think once it plays out, we see where it goes. If it follows the lead of what the proponents propose, will be like all the you know, the great things that happen from tax reform or from net neutrality laws being diminished, you know, things like that.
Yeah,
I think that you start to see, you know, maybe a change in, well, except for the stubborn people, but that's I hope that that's not the majority of people. Although I could be wrong, but you know, I think you start to see a sway in how people think about these things now. Yeah. At the same time, you're talking to a skeptic here as well. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. I'm looking at it in a kind of a skeptical view.
I want to see follow through. At the same right? time, like some like there's got to press release anything, through, right?
That's exactly
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
Yes. Exactly right, man. And you know, idea like I'm not going to jump into net neutrality, but just, you know, as a quick example, you know, net neutrality. Going away, you know, does that make it more of a consumer based, you know, decision making process that, you know, maybe more people enter the market? You know, if that all happens, then guess what? Getting rid of net neutrality was a good thing. You could see that there's already companies like AT&T, Google, Apple that are poised
real quick, though,
to make moves on that.
Not to jump into the net neutrality thing, but the real quick mm-hmm. distinction I want to make is, and this is where politics and maybe even things with our first segment that we talked about, how people applying very technical and academic things that are in just common everyday discussions and not relying on experts and just mm-hmm. taking authorities for their word. The concept of net neutrality being killed is not, that's not necessarily true, right? Like
right.
what we're talking about is FCC implemented a certain amount of additional regulation on a market. Mm-hmm. But the core for which people generally describe net neutrality has actually already been illegal. The concept of favoring something over the other is actually illegal. You could, like, right now, that can't be done.
I think a
regardless
lot of
net neutrality, regardless of what you call it.
2014, right before net neutrality came into play, there was a huge lawsuit between Netflix and Comcast. I think probably. It was yeah. because Comcast was throttling back, you know, in an effort to bully Netflix because mm-hmm. of a content issue. And there was a lawsuit that ensued. And, you know, that's still unlawful, right?
Yeah,
you
can't, that was unlawful then. And it continuously is unlawful. Yeah.
And it's still unlawful. And I think people forget about that. You know, you start seeing all these things. And again, it goes back to these memes that you see oversimplifying complex issues where, you know, I've seen one go around in regards to net neutrality that talks about, you know, Facebook's going to charge you this and blah, blah, blah. And I'm saying, like, how dumb is this? Because number one, if a private company wants to charge you for their services, they're going to do it. That has nothing to do with net neutrality one way or another. They're not going to, because you'd stop using them. It's not a necessity. It's not a commodity. We don't need Facebook, you know, or whatever, you know, whatever it might be. I said, yeah, you're talking about private companies charging you now for things because of net neutrality laws. Like it makes no sense at all. You know, the people that now, what I will say is, you know, you do have two major telecom companies in Comcast and Verizon. They can benefit from they can profit from net neutrality laws being loosened, right, or diminished, or however you want to actually look at it, right? Because of the fact that now they can say, well, you know what, now they can't throttle back. They can't, because that is unlawful if they do it in a competitive nature, right?
Well,
they can charge for higher
or
speeds.
Or what they can do is they could actually go to Netflix
tiers.
They could go to Netflix and say, hey, you actually can install hardware, pay for it yourself on our network, which will provide faster speeds for people on my network for your service, right? And they could give the Netflix the option of saying, hey, we'll charge you for that. Or what's going to happen is Netflix will pass that on to their consumers, right?
What they're doing, though, is they're failing to realize that there's a huge thing that's happening in the background right now. With Google is one of the front runners in it, but there's a bunch of companies doing it, including our cell phone providers that are going to basically be putting over the air ISPs in a play, and that's a game changer, because then you're not really so dependent on the hardwired infrastructure that Comcast and Verizon provide.
Well, Facebook's even working on like blimps and stuff. For providing,
and it's going to go that way, man. This is the age of the hotspot right now. You know what I mean? We're no longer going to really need that hardwire. Now, Verizon has begun last year, I think it was, to start their 1 gig service. But you know, to kind of solidify the idea that you need fiber, you can't do it over the air, which is a bunch of bullshit, because I think consumers are starting to get a little bit more savvy and realize that they don't need a gig. I, for instance, stream every single thing in my house, and I have a 25 megabyte per second download speed, and I can stream 4 units. My computer and my phones and Rokus and everything flawless with no buffering. You know, I think people are starting to understand the idea between bandwidth and speeds and what they're actually offering, and how out of this world crazy it is. You know what I mean? Like to be offering such such technologies that aren't needed just yet, you know. So, you know, the idea that, okay, you know, yeah, maybe Verizon could charge me more for a gig service rather than, you know, I don't know, 100 megabyte per second download service. yeah, maybe they could charge me more for that, but do I even need that anyway? You know what I mean? So I think consumers, it's also going to force consumers to get a little bit more savvy and understand what they're even talking about in the first place.
One thing people need to understand, people need to try to kind of conceptualize too, is that we're talking about internet service, a service provider and a content provider, right? We're talking about Comcast, Verizon versus Netflix, Google, Amazon, whoever, right? Hulu. And the way these markets work, or the valuations and the money that flows through these different markets, there's going to be less emphasis on the service provider side because of all the money that's in the content provider side, right? That is all, that money is going to start shifting and flowing to content more and more and more in the coming years. But you'll see companies like Facebook is a content provider, right? They don't set up any sort of infrastructure or network. They serve you content based on social media content, right? So they're doing research and development. I guarantee you Amazon, well, I know Amazon's doing research and development. They have their whole cloud infrastructure, right? You know, all these different content providers realize that they live and die by access to their content. If there was no access to their content, they wouldn't exist, right?
Well, you know, the amazing thing to that point, Joe, is that a lot, like, we're going to, you know, it's going to be amazing what the consumer base sees and changes with content providers in 2018, because HBO and Showtime already did it, where they made their standalone service because their contracts ended with Comcast and Verizon, and you know, that's flying high. I mean, that's a great service that they provide at a pretty, you know, everybody's going to that a la carte type of content, you know, providing. But what we're going to start seeing is, you know, right now sports is one of the big things where, you know, the these telecom companies have bought out contracts for like years and years to come. Well, 2018, a lot of those go, you know, come into fruition where they don't have to pay into that anymore. That contract expires and it's void. And these people are not very happy with these telecom companies because they're actually limiting their content, you know, for their own reasons, right? So you're going to have a bunch of standalone content going into the a la carte net infrastructure, if you will, for content. And that kind of leaves Comcast and Verizon, I'm just using them as examples because they're the two biggies, right? That kind of leaves them out of the content market at that point. You know, at that point, all they are is a service provider, no longer. Because right now, with Comcast Sportsnet, which is now NBC Sportsnet, ESPN, and all these other guys, you know, Comcast has poised themselves as content providers and
All these moves, you know what I mean? Moves to the content end, right? Like Disney's bought part of Fox Studios. AT&T was buying someone up. Like Comcast has been buying up content for years now. And because that's content is going to drive all this, right? That's why it's like everyone's very upset and very crazy about net neutrality. But I'm telling you, in several years, access to the internet is not going to be a problem, right? Because these content providers, there's so much money, there's so much at stake for them that they are going to ensure through their own investment, in whether it be infrastructure or some other way, to get their content to you, right? Whether it's Facebook flying a blimp over your head, or you know, Disney, you know, creating little cubes and putting them in and connecting them to different networks and stuff like that, and putting out Wi-Fi signals, right? So it's like we're very, very worried about it right now, but it's very temporary.
As limited as it was. Yeah. Well, you know, and that's the thing. Before net neutrality laws came into play, our infrastructure was pretty limited. And we're only talking about 2 years ago, right? 2 or 3 years ago. But with that said, I mean, there has been so many advancements in this particular technology over the past year, let alone 2 to 3 years, that, you know, wired systems are going out. You know, we're not going to, you know, what fiber was poised to do 3 years ago, you can do over the air right now. You know what I mean? And it's just, I think that's just a technological knowledge gap, I guess, that exists from consumer to provider. And they want the provider wants that knowledge gap. You know what I mean? They don't want the consumer to understand that technology.
So Rich, since we haven't heard from you in quite a while.
Sorry, Rich.
How you doing over there? What's going on? What's happening?
Hey, I'm here. What's up? Hey, how's it going?
I apologize. I think we're just kind of ranting, Anthony and myself.
I apologize, guys, for the rants.
No, it's okay. Go ahead. I enjoy listening.
Well, we're on 48 minutes. So Rich, I'm inclined to give you at least a couple minutes here of a platform to talk about a lot of stuff that we just kind of flew by you because we were just ranting. So net neutrality, tax bill. Hey man, go right and dive into white privilege if you want. Let's do it. Go.
Ditto.
Well, you do have to remember the word. You will have a word at the end of this podcast.
Oh shit. Okay. I got to pick a word. All right.
No, you know what?
It's
now.
Our episode 25. We could go a little longer than 45 minutes.
Well, we did do that with the last episode, by the way. We went over an hour and like 15 or something. But it's fine. We can keep going. But
We'll cap it at an hour.
So net neutrality, we've dove head first into net neutrality here, it seems like. So, Rich, what are your thoughts on that?
No, I mean, I think.
Are you net neutral?
I think I'm a little bit torn only because I don't think there's real competition in the market right now as far as providers go. But like you said, there's so many content providers now. You have Slingbox and Netflix and Amazon Prime and Hulu and all these other people. You know, Google, like you said, is getting in there. To where, you know, they probably, I mean, somebody, especially like Google, does have the money to start laying down cable and maybe becoming a substantial provider of internet access. So I think your arguments were all valid. I agree. I'm not one of those people that thought the sky was falling when net neutrality was repealed. I wasn't too excited about it only because of the climate that exists now as far as ISP providers. But you know, it's something that it's a wait and see for me. I mean, I'm not really going to try to speculate what'll happen. I think that I have good faith, probably a little bit more so than other people in big business and corporations, because they want to keep us happy. They want, you know, a happy consumer base. They want us to buy their products. So I don't think they're going to do anything crazy to you know, get us to make us miserable and go, well, you don't have a choice, sort of a thing, because, you know, there's always a way, you know, around the system. But But yeah, I mean, I really don't disagree with anything that you guys said. I'm pretty much in the middle on the whole thing.
You bring up an observation I thought was funny, because I noticed this with not just net neutrality, but also the tax bill and probably pretty much everything else in the political sphere. But this concept of like doomsday scenario for everything, like, it's crazy, man. Like, if you just go on Twitter, and maybe I'm just torturing myself by doing it, but if you just like the whole time when the net neutrality thing was going on, it's like you would either think like the world was literally going to end the moment it was like repealed or taken off the table, or the world was going to like turn into like this capitalist utopia. It was like one or the other. Like, it's yeah, like, well, holy shit, guys, calm down. Like, this is not happening. Relax.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there's a real valid point there, because somebody like Slingbox, and I was actually talking about this with a coworker the other day, but Slingbox has a really smart idea of a la carte TV, you know, because say you really like something like Turner Classic Movies. Well, you got to go like three packages up to get that with cable. But if you want something like that on Slingbox, you could just pick that, and you're paying like an extra $10.
You're right. You're right. But I just want to let you know, I have a bone to pick with that Slingbox service that you're talking about, because although they've branded themselves as a la carte TV, they're not. They still require like a $25 or $35 minimum package you have to buy.
There is a package.
It's essentially de facto the same thing as buying a Comcast package or a Verizon package.
But it's really way less expensive. It's way less expensive, though.
No, because I pay $60 a month for 100 down, 100 up on fiber, Fios, right? I can literally pay $20 more and get a TV package.
I think I'm paying...
Actually, less than that, $10 more, I think I get a TV package.
Like $89 or something like that was the deal we got.
Yeah.
And I don't have any TV, and I just have internet, and I just use Slingbox, Hulu, Slingbox, Netflix, and I have a Prime membership, which is $100 payment once a year. So I have plenty of stuff to watch on TV. I'm entertained all the time. The only thing that I don't like about Slingbox is that for certain things like sporting events, like I got it really for football because I love the Eagles. And first of all, they don't offer CBS. It's only NBC and Fox, which the majority of the games are on there. But if you get a game on CBS, you're screwed. And then the Thursday night games, you'd think you'd be able to watch that too, but somehow they don't own the rights or something. It's like they're blacked out when you go to watch Thursday night football on the NFL
Network.
You know
what the nice thing is, though? You can supplement that pretty easily in the local spectrum with a HD antenna. Get all of that for free.
So
my setup here, I pay about between my internet, which now I have a 50 up, 50 down plan. And then with that, I also have Hulu and Netflix and Sling, a watered down package with Sling. And I have my HD antenna. I think I pay total. We have a couple of other subscriptions, HBO, Showtime. I think I'd pay a total of like $90 a month for everything. And I have more content than I used to. I mean, one of the problems is with the packages that I guess like Comcast, Verizon, et cetera, offer, is that you're paying for 1,000 channels, 900 of which you're never going
to
watch.
But here's, you know, the thing. Here's my thing with Sling, right? And I was just telling Rich this when he stepped away to get a drink. The Sling service, although they bill themselves as a la carte, isn't, though. You have to pay a minimum of $20. So with me, I pay $60 a month. I get 100 up, 100 down. With that service, I'm at, what, 80 bucks? Like, so I'm at 80 bucks for just Sling, and that, and then I'm getting channels with Sling I don't want. Right. Then I have to pay an extra I have to pay $5 or $10 more for the channels I want on top of that $20. So to me, it's a step in the right direction, but it's still bullshit. It's not a la carte. Sure. It's still
not totally a la carte. I mean, but you have now every market is different. You're in a different state than I am. But I was paying upwards around $220 a month. Actually, they wanted to up it to $240 a month when I finally quit Comcast, for a pretty watered down version, as far as TV content goes. And that included my same internet package as well as the content that they were providing me for TV. And you know, I started realizing that it was just, it was absurd how much money, you know, there's a few limitations in terms of convenience, you know, with Comcast, you just have one interface, one GUI that you can kind of like go through and pick what you want to watch and see a guide. So it doesn't feel like that. You got to know where to find the content, but you know, that takes about 2 weeks to get used to. And then suddenly you have all of that content plus more and you're paying much less, you know what I mean? So it depends on how, you know, they're banking on the less savvy consumer base, which is, you know, a large percentage of the consumer base. But I think the consumer base, especially adding millennials into the consumer base now as they're buying their own homes and paying for their own bills, they're much more technologically savvy, and they're coming up with ways to find the content. You know, Rich was talking about blackout stuff. There's plenty of virtual VPNs that are completely legal that you can use to, you know, switch your VPN, you know, so that you can get local networks and stuff like that. You know, there's a couple of services out there that cost maybe like $2 to $3 a month that'll do it for you. You can set up your own if you wanted to. You know, there's a lot out there, and I think because, you know, right now it's not totally a la carte like you said, but I think because those technologies are there and people are getting more savvy, I think that it's going to be a declining market for the major content providers like Comcast and Verizon, because people are only going to get more savvy. And look, we're talking about a market where other companies are going to see this market trend and want to cater to those people. You know what I mean? So they're going to say, hey, you know what? They're looking for this kind of content. Let's try to capitalize on it. And that's going to only offer more opportunities, I guess, for, you know, for certain content providers to give new types of content. You know, we're locked into what we've been used to for the past 20 to 30 years. And I think there's a big movement away from that.
And also, I mean, can't we just agree that with Slingbox, you might have to pay like $25, but the ratio and proportion of channels that you don't watch is way smaller than channels that you don't watch with cable. And for the price, I mean, you really can't beat it. So like there might be like four Spanish channels and, you know, maybe like a weird news channel that I don't pay any attention to that are on there. But that's like 5 out of like 30.
I think it's hard for me to buy into that, because I could literally go on my Fios account right now and add 10 or 20 bucks to it and get 500 channels. And even though I'm not going to watch most,
you're going to watch.
But what does it matter? At that point, it's a value proposition. Why would I pay $20 for 10 channels I might watch more often than I could get the same 10 channels plus 490 more for the same price?
I think it depends on your location and the market in that location. Because when I was looking at cutting the cord, you know, with cable, with Comcast, they were going to charge me $240 because the bill went up. Okay, the charges went up. And I said, well, what would it cost for me to go completely just standard, watered down internet and content? You know what I mean? What's your like basic cable price? And because I wasn't a new customer, I was still looking at like $180 to $190 a month. And I was so turned off by that.
It was like $135 a month, and we weren't getting HBO or anything. Like, we weren't getting even like TBS and TNT and shit. Like, we weren't getting anything. And it was like $140 a month. It's like, you know, fuck that shit, man. Like, for like pretty much local channels and, you know, maybe like something stupid, like not even Encore. I forget what I even had, but it was so like not even worth it. So I said, you know, this is ridiculous. We're paying all this money and we're not getting anything for it. So we got rid of that. We just got the phone and internet. And then I just started research, and I got started out with Hulu and Netflix, but then it just got really like taxing not being able to watch live TV, especially because I love, you know, like I said, the Eagles. And so, you know, I traded out Hulu for Slingbox, and, you know, I'm pretty happy with where I'm at.
It's also a whole racket when it comes to the hardware, right? So like both big companies look at the hardware rentals as a big part of their, you know, revenue stream. you know, Verizon has a lock on it because you have to have their hardware to support the fiber connections. But, you know, when you don't really need those and you just stream everything straight from internet, you know, you're kind of taken away from the necessity to have their hardware, you know, pay an extra $10 a month for an HD box. Well, everything I stream is HD, so I don't need that anymore, you know?
Yeah. And like when I worked for Comcast for a very brief period of time, apparently like how they measure their worth is TV sales. So even though I was working for like business internet, like pretty much that's like what we were selling. Like if you didn't sell TV with the package, that was considered like a giant failure, even though TV was only like an extra $6 or something a month. Like if you didn't sell that, they're like, man, that's bad. Like you got to get that triple play. Yeah. So that's pretty much how they measure their worth is like TV sales. Like they don't really pay as much attention to like phone and internet, especially not phone.
Got to get that triple play.
Yeah, yeah.
We've hit 62 minutes.
Sorry, Melissa.
We're all going to be in trouble. Anyway.
All right. Well, it was great talking to you guys.
Yeah, episode 25. We'll call it a wrap. You can find us on Facebook at The Podcast Without a Name, on Twitter at No Name Podcast, or you can download the podcast at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spreaker, SoundCloud. Everywhere, I guess.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of other places we're probably chilling.
YouTube, which after January 1st, you will not be able to watch on Fire TV for God some reason.
It. Yeah, because of the dispute between Amazon and Google. Surprise. Content providers are fighting each other.
Until I used to go to
if only we had net neutrality. If only we had net neutrality, guys.
Yeah.
Well, we survived net neutrality as we know it, leaving us. So we're back to 2015, everyone. Yay. The tax bill has happened. It was signed. It will be happening. You'll probably have more money in your pockets. So we'll hear what you have to say about that at some point later on. We're going to give Rich the last word here, of course, as always. Anyone else want to say something before we get to that point, though?
No, good talk, guys.
Yeah, remember when you're having remember when you're having conversations with people and you're trying to talk about very complex concepts and things that you hear from your favorite websites and stuff like that, to give a little bit more time to experts rather than authority on this. And don't throw around these academic and technical terms without really understanding them, or at least acknowledge that you might not understand them, and look and seek the truth, if you will.
You just might find that your conversations go more smoothly and more friendly.
Yeah, exactly. And Rich, on that note, we will give you the last word.
Plutocracy. Plutocracy. Look it up.